Argument is Perry versus McCautry. Mr. Cook.
Please, the court. I'm Dave Cook, and I represent Mr. Perry. Mr. Perry's first claim here is that his trial counsel was ineffective under the Strickland standard, because in a case where it was not contested at all that Mr. Perry did not directly commit the murder in this case and the attempted murders in this case, and in a case where Mr. Perry's only defense at trial was that he was guilty of felony murder instead of first-degree intentional homicide. That was the reason he went to trial. In that kind of a case, his lawyer's failure to integrate...
You know, it'd be nice if one of the lawyers to this case had said what integrate means. This is a term I've never heard before.
Well,
judges may know it, but I've never heard it.
I'm not sure I heard of it before this case either.
Well, and if you hadn't heard of it either, why don't you tell us what it means so we're not in the dark about what you're talking about?
The concept here is to put together the party to a crime liability theory with the particular charge, in this case, that the defense theory is seeking the jury to consider. The state... integrated or put together.
Well, look, be concrete, would you?
Okay.
What is it you wanted?
Well, the felony murder instruction, as it was written, the jury was instructed, if you find that Mr. Perry caused the death of Harry Brown, and this is...
Okay, then what you wanted was what?
The instruction should have said, if you find that Mr. Perry or another caused the death, then the instruction would have fit the facts of the case.
Okay, so you're just complaining about the felony murder instruction, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, that's correct. It was a failure. The only way Mr. Perry could have been found guilty of felony murder was being a party to a crime.
Now, how do you deal with the argument that I think would plague, you know, all these lesser-included cases? Your opponent says, well, his lawyer... may have had a very good reason not to object to this erroneous instruction. It's quite true that the felony murder instruction, if the jury followed it, would preclude their convicting Perry of felony murder. But on the other hand, that would give him a chance at an acquittal, because the jury, you know, faced with a choice between this party to a crime offense, which doesn't seem to fit him very well either, an acquittal, they might decide, well, acquit. Because very often defense lawyers don't... We've had cases where prosecutors insist on a lesser-included instruction over the opposition of the defense lawyer. Because the defense lawyer hopes that if there is no lesser-included instruction, which might be the focal point for the jury, they can get an acquittal.
This the state's argument, the way I understand it, is not that... the possible strategic reason for not seeking this putting together of the parties to crime with felony murder was not that the defense thought there was a possibility of acquittal. This was not that kind of case, because Mr. Perry admitted from opening statement on in the trial that he was guilty of armed robbery and of felony murder.
I don't understand it. Why did... if there is... if whether he admits or doesn't admit... If there's no, I forgot about the armed robbery. If there's no felony murder instruction in the case, or there's a felony murder instruction that excludes him,
yes,
then the jury's choices are convict him of you know, party to a crime, which he doesn't seem clearly guilty of at all, acquit him, or convict him of armed robbery. Now, isn't armed robbery a less grave offense than felony murder?
Well, the risk here is that...
There's a risk, but answer my question. Isn't armed robbery a less serious offense?
Yes, that's a less serious offense.
Then he is at least a shot, depending on whether he's a risk taker. He might prefer to put to the jury the choice between, you know, just armed robbery and armed robbery plus party to a murder than to have felony murder in there.
In this case, Mr. Perry was not contesting the felony murder at all.
What do you mean not contesting? Look,
he was contesting.
His lawyer has to make a judgment. And maybe the lawyer thought, maybe originally he thought he had no chance on felony murder, but then he sees this instruction, which excludes felony murder. And he might say, well, great, felony murder is now out of the case. My client isn't guilty of party to a crime, of murder, so the jury is just going to convict him of armed robbery, and he'll be better off. Now, isn't that a possible thinking process for the lawyer?
It wasn't the process in this case, because the defense lawyer argued from in opening statement and in his closing argument, my client is guilty of felony murder. That was the whole strategy here, was to avoid the possibility of a conviction of first-degree intentional homicide with a life imprisonment term with no possibility that Mr. Perry would ever be out on parole, and that's in fact what happened.
What is the punishment for felony murder?
The felony murder punishment is at that time was 40 years in prison with the possibility of parole at 25% of the service of the term. If he had been convicted of felony murder in addition to the two attempted first-degree intentional homicides, and in addition to the armed robbery, he could have gotten 100 years in prison, but he still would have had at least an opportunity of parole, perhaps in 25 or 30 years. Because he was convicted of first-degree intentional homicide, his parole eligibility date was set at age 100 for him. So
what was he sentenced to for armed robbery? 60 years, did you say?
I believe on the armed robbery, he got 20 years.
20 years.
Yes.
So 60 altogether, you're saying?
Yes, there were two attempted first-degree intentional homicides. Each of those could have carried a 20-year term also. And then in addition,
well, was the armed robbery consecutive to? Well, that if he'd been convicted of felony murder, armed robbery be consecutive to that?
The 40-year term that he could have gotten on the felony murder would have included the armed robbery penalty. Yeah. So as it stands, he got 20 years for. He got a life term for the first-degree intentional homicide, and then he got 20 years for the attempted first-degree intentional homicide terms. And he
so you're saying that the lawyer was going for felony murder,
yes,
but
yes,
had failed to object to an instruction which actually prevented the jury from. So that's your argument.
Exactly, and that was the defense theory, that, right, that this is felony murder, this is not first-degree intentional homicide. And as the district court found, the lawyer really should have put together a party to a crime liability theory with that felony murder instruction, because that's the only way the jury could have reached the defense theory. That's the only way the jury could have reached the felony murder case. The Wisconsin Court of Appeals, as well as the district court, rejected Mr. Perry's claim with the idea that there was no prejudice here. And I think this court has to look at whether the Wisconsin Court of Appeals ruling on prejudice is an unreasonable application of Strickland. And I believe it is, because what the court ruled is that the jury instructions, there's no prejudice because the jury instructions in their entirety cured this problem. Well, there's no explanation as to how the instructions in their entirety could possibly cure this problem, because you have a jury that has to follow their instructions, and they're looking at felony murder, which is the defense theory, but they're not given any way under the facts of the case that they can actually find Mr. Perry guilty of felony murder. Now, the district court suggested that the party to a crime instruction that was given as to first-degree intentional homicide may have carried over and had some application to the felony murder charge, but it simply, on its face, it didn't do that, and the jury was never instructed on party to a crime as to felony murder.
But given the evidence in this case, is there really a reasonable possibility the outcome would have been different?
I think there is a reasonable probability that the jury had the, because it was not contested at all that Mr. Perry fired no shots. He was not the person that directly committed these crimes. He was present. He by his own admission, he intended an armed robbery, but he had no knowledge, no intent that this gun be fired, that these murders, the murder occur, or the attempted murder
occur. They don't carry around guns in that kind of situation without the intent to use it if necessary.
Well, this is a question that the jury would have had to decide, and the very fact that the state did not object to the felony murder instruction and that the trial judge gave the felony murder instruction, instructed the jury on it, indicates that at least the state and the court believed that there was a reasonable probability that the jury could find him guilty on that lesser offense. I see that my time has expired.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cook. Mr. Becker?
May it please the court, my name is David Becker. I'm an assistant attorney general from the state of Wisconsin, and I'm appearing here this morning on behalf of the respondent appellee. This morning, there are actually two issues in the case, but only one has been addressed by my opponent, and I'll confine my remarks to that issue also in the absence of questions regarding it. The issue that was addressed by my opponent this morning was whether or not he received, or his client received, the ineffective assistance of counsel because there was not objection made by defense counsel at the time of trial to the way the jury instructions were put together. The claim being that the way the jury instructions read, they basically precluded a conviction of the lesser offense of felony murder if literally applied.
Well, that's true, isn't it?
I'd make this concession, but no more, I guess. If one simply rested from the context of the totality of the instructions and from the context of the totality of the case, the felony murder instruction, I guess the answer would have to be yes, because the felony murder instruction spoke in terms of the defendant causing the death. And everybody agrees that the defendant didn't cause the death. But I don't think we judge jury instructions in that kind of artificial isolation. And I think the U.S. Supreme Court has indicated, and I've quoted...
Yeah, but be concrete. Well, what are you pointing to in hearing this error?
What I'm pointing to are a number of things. First of all of the evidence in the case, no one ever contended that the defendant did the actual shooting.
Well, wait a second. You've lost me completely now.
No one ever contended that...
You're saying the instruction, although the instruction is wrong, but the instruction is wrong, but it's so goofy that it would be read differently, or what?
Well,
you have another argument to go with that?
That was my introduction to the argument that I want to make. The jury was instructed on felony murder. What the judge instructed them on felony murder. What was the jury to conclude from that? The jury had to conclude that felony murder...
Is felony murder mentioned elsewhere in the instructions, or is this the only mention of it?
Well, I'm not sure I know how to answer that. Obviously,
you say the instructions have to be read as a whole. So I'm asking you, is there somewhere else where felony murder is mentioned?
I'm sorry, and I was going... All right. Focusing purely on the instructions. When the instructions spoke...
I asked an extremely simple question.
Okay, the answer would be... Was it mentioned by name? No. But let me point you to an instruction where that encompassed it. And I refer you to appendix page 46 of the appellant's brief in this case, where the jury instructions are all laid out, and where the jury is introduced to the concept of the theory of liability under which the state was asking them to convict him of first-degree intentional homicide. And where the jury was instructed that you become liable not only for a crime that you intend to commit, in this case the armed robbery, but you become liable for any crime that is a natural and probable consequence of it. And that's the language that we've used. At the top of page appendix 46, and it's page 43 from the transcript that's reproduced on that page, it says, with regard to a member of conspiracy, a member of conspiracy is also guilty of any other crime which is committed in pursuance of the intended crime and which under the circumstances is a natural and probable consequence.
What does that have to do with felony murder?
Because felony murder is included within any other crime. And the following paragraph...
Felony, you don't need a conspiracy for... I don't understand you.
The theory here is that the defendant conspired to commit armed robbery.
Yes, but this is for this offense, this party to a crime, life imprisonment offense. This isn't about the elements of felony murder.
That's what the instructions go on to talk about, but here they make it clear that we're talking about this theory of liability being applicable to, quote, any other crime.
There are two theories of liability. One is this conspiracy, party to a crime, intentional homicide business, and another is felony murder. Now, this instruction you're reading to us has nothing to do with felony murder.
Well, I suggest that it does, but I suggest
it's
felony
murder. How can it? I don't know what you're talking about. How can it?
Because if the felony murder, if the murder itself is committed by another person, the defendant becomes liable for it because he entered into a conspiracy of which that felony murder committed by another person was a natural and probable consequence.
But that's not felony murder. That's another offense. Look, felony murder, you're guilty of felony murder even if the felony that occurs is something that wasn't part of the conspiracy and you didn't anticipate. It's strict liability. It's not conspiracy. You wouldn't need felony murder as a separate offense if the person was guilty of conspiracy.
I need it as a separate offense if the person is guilty of the conspiracy, but the other crime is not a natural and probable consequence of the conspiracy.
Right, so it doesn't. So it's not part of this. What's on page A46, which you just read us, which is about the natural and probable consequence.
Well, I guess we'll have to.
I think you're in a tremendous muddle here.
Well,
Now, let me ask you this. Are the crimes themselves segregated into instructions just for felony murder and just for first-degree homicide or whatever it is, or do you have parts of the instructions that refer to matters that pertain to both crimes?
Well, initially the instructions are segregated into the two offenses. And then they're introduced to this concept of party to the crime liability for a crime that is a natural and probable consequence. And then after that, a first-degree intentional homicide is brought back into the picture.
Well, I didn't answer my question. Are there parts of the instruction that relate to both offenses that could be fairly read to relate to both offenses? For example, on page 48 of the appendix, mere presence at the scene of the crime and knowledge that the crime is being committed are not sufficient to establish that the defendant aided and abetted the crime, unless you find beyond a reasonable doubt the defendant was the participant and not merely a knowing spectator. Does that apply to a specific crime, or is that a general instruction as to the crimes charged in this case?
Well, that's a general instruction as to the crimes charged, and particularly with regard to the aiding and abetting theory of liability with respect to the crime.
All right, are there other instructions such as that apply to both offenses? That's what Judge Posner was getting at. You have instructions that pertain to both offenses that can be read as a whole that take care of the problem.
Well, I think that the instruction that I appointed the court to relates to both offenses because it talks about any other crime. I did not convince Judge Posner of that. And perhaps I should go on to say that our argument does not rise or fall on whether or not the instructions cured themselves in the abstract.
You have this argument about that it may have been a tactical reason, but you have a comment on what Mr. Cook said. Mr. Cook said that the lawyer, far from wanting to roll the dice and maybe just get off with armed robbery, actually told the jury that his client was guilty of felony murder. Is that correct?
I think that's a fair reading of the record.
But that wipes out your tactical argument.
No, because my tactical argument is based on the fact that he stood a chance, if he's right, and I don't think he's right, that these jury instructions would have confused the jury. The same defect appeared with regard to the other charges, the attempted murder charges, and that he could have had a tactical reason that he wanted to let that confusion stand with respect to the attempted murder charges.
two wrongs would offset each other.
Well, that would be the theory. Now, I'm not suggesting that's the strongest argument in the world, but I'm suggesting...
All right, well, that's good. So what is your strongest argument?
My strongest argument is the one that I think was Judge Kaney.
Instructions must be read as a whole in harmony with each other.
Well, I think there's more than that. I think there is the fact that under the evidence adduced in this case, there was really no reasonable basis for there may have been a reasonable basis, but no reasonable likelihood or reasonable probability, as Strickland.
In other words, your evidence was so strong, there's no reasonable likelihood.
Yes, and I think this court has said it in so many words that if an intentional chilling is not a natural and probable consequence of an armed robbery, when would we ever have a chilling be the natural and probable consequence of armed robbery? That's the Fela decision, which I cite and I say is controlling.
So you're saying when an armed robbery results in a death, all the robbers are guilty of murder. That's your proposition.
When it results in a death where you find the person who caused the death intentionally killed the person, and that the jury found that here, then I'm saying yes. Or I'm at least saying there is no reasonable probability that they will not find it.
Don't you think that some jurors would consider that a little harsh?
Well, whether they would or not, that is the law.
Because that's punishing for first-degree murder something that is not actually intentional.
And that's precisely what the natural problem. That's precisely what the natural problem consequences.
Well, you can see why a jury might consider felony murder more appropriate for such a person.
My response to that would be what, and I think my red light is on. I'll finish my sentence here. What the U.S. Supreme Court said in Strickland versus Washington, and that is that in determining the question of ineffective assistance of counsel, and I don't remember the exact words. I may not be quoting them exactly, but that the defendant has no right to the luck of a lawless decision maker. And I think what you're suggesting is something akin to jury nullification, that they would not have followed the instructions, that they would have felt more comfortable convicting of something else. That, I don't think, is an appropriate analysis under Strickland.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Becker. Mr. Cook, how much time does he have? No time. Do you have anything further? You'd like a minute or... No. Okay, well, you don't have to take it. Wondered if you wanted it. Yes, because that, after all, is Mr. Becker's strongest argument.
The question of whether the natural and probable consequences of an armed robbery is always an intentional homicide, in the sense of, is that foreseeable? Yes, it's foreseeable. But the state, in this case, did not object to the giving of the felony murder instruction. And under the standard for giving a lesser-included offense instruction, the court has to consider, are there reasonable grounds for an acquittal on the greater charge? The state didn't object. I think the state at trial recognized, yes, there's reasonable grounds here for an acquittal on the greater charge. A reasonable jury could say, well, even if an intentional homicide is foreseeable, this Mr. Perry is not guilty of that. He was there for
the state bound by the decision not to object, which would indicate that there was a possibility that he could be convicted of less than that.
Well, I think certainly the position here is inconsistent with what the state's position was at trial. It's also inconsistent with the trial court's decision to give that instruction on felony murder on the lesser included offense.
Okay, thank you very much. And Mr. Cook, you were asked to represent Mr. Perry, were you not?
I was appointed. This court.
Technically, I think a request is to look at it. But anyway, we thank you for your vigorous efforts on behalf of your client.
Thank you.